where the arcane, mysterious, and enlightening training in Force skills will commence. It is here that Dalian Brock's fall will begin. Chapter 3, The Good and the Great. Not every journeyer will complete their great journey. Some will fall victim to Tython's many dangerous landscapes or creatures. Some will lose themselves. Some may even lose their way in the Force and leave Tython far behind, scattering out to the system, lost in a much more fundamental way. But as Jedi, we must accept this, because this is not an existence of absolutes. Life is a challenge, and facing that challenge is what makes the good great. Master Dila Jan Morola, 3533 TYA, Thoyor arrival. Even though she had been away from home for 4 years, Lannery still kept to Tython time. She was used to it. It suited her natural sleep patterns, and she saw little point in adapting her ship to standard time. In her less guarded moments, she might also admit that it reminded her of home. The computer calculated the optimum flight path from Tython to Calamar for the time of year and current planet alignments. And before committing to the route, Lannery also calculated it manually. The computer was never wrong in such matters. The navigational elements were programmed and designed by the Jedi's most experienced space travelers. But she was always pleased when her calculations came out the same. Rather than questioning the computer, she was testing herself. Pushing her peacemaker to its limits, it took a little over 7 days to reach Calamar. She used this time to meditate, prepare herself for the coming mission, exercise, and review every aspect of the information downloaded to the Peacemaker's computers. There wasn't much. Whatever contacts had informed the Jedi of Dale's scheme had not been very thorough. Rumors, speculation, and a few hazy images. But even in those grainy images of covert meetings and mysterious exchanges, she recognized the face of her brother. He looked older, of course. But she was surprised at how much older, as if he'd lived 3 lifetimes since she had last seen him, not 9 years. He was taller, thinner. His child's sadness translated into adult bitterness. His dusky skin had turned darker and more rugged. And there was something haunting about his blurred visage. Lannery berated herself for letting her thoughts of his death cloud how she viewed him now. Yet the idea remained. Seeing those images of Dale felt like looking at a ghost. "We'll meet again," she said to the screen, "and I'll ask why you let me think you were dead all these years." For the first few days of the journey, she left Dale's image on the cockpit flat screen, also feeding it through to a screen in the living quarters directly behind the cockpit. A reminder of who she sought and who she had lost. But seeing him there only confused her more, so by day 5, she left the screen blank. Lannery had visited Calamar twice over the past 4 years. The first time was to act as mediator in a troublesome deal between 3 landmass developers, all of them bickering over an island called Hang Laden in the planet's vast southern ocean. Normally, a Jedi would not have been concerned with such matters, but the Jedi Council had sent Lannery because of the island's suspected archaeological importance. Though the island appeared bare, it was believed that an ancient structure, possibly of Gree origin, existed a kilometer beneath the surface. Her presence had been resented, but she had taken an active role in the negotiations, ensuring that each of the 3 interested parties had a portion of land to develop. More important, she had covertly protected the cave network that might lead deep down to that ruin from ancient history. The Force illusions she had left behind of rock falls and impassable ravines would last for 100 years. Her second time on Calamar had been less peaceful. That time, her sword had been wetted with blood. Even so, she did not pretend for a moment that she knew this place. A good Jedi was always on guard and ready for surprises. Especially a Jedi on a mission as important as hers. As she entered the atmosphere and her computer contacted air traffic control, she saw two Calamar defense ships shadowing her 30 kilometers away. They would be no threat. It was more likely that the pilots were excited at spotting a peacemaker, and they'd go home that night to tell their families and friends that they'd seen a Jedi arrive. They followed for the next hour, and just before peeling away, they made contact. She replied with a gentle push of grace and humor, responding to them while revealing nothing. "If we met in a tavern, we might even be friends," she thought, smiling. It was a subtle Jedi talent, but one that often served her well. They disappeared from her screen when she was more than 100 kilometers from her destination. She approached Rahul Yon above a startling azure sea. The peacemaker shuddered as she passed across the waves. She was so low that spray from the sea misted the windows, but she enjoyed flying like this. Out in space, there was no context. She could fly for days with the starscape changing hardly at all. Depth was infinite, and distances were so vast that her mind could barely grasp them. But down here, she was close to something. Sometimes closeness mattered. Rahul Yon had been built on an archipelago stretching out into the southern ocean. There were 5 large islands and countless smaller ones, all of them developed, and hundreds of bridges, both large and small, spanned the spaces between landmasses. Gleaming white spires reached stark fingers to the sky, and several classes of cloud chaser airships drifted between them like lazy birds flocking around ash trees back on Typhon. Lower down, buildings and streets clung to the islands and sometimes protruded out over the ocean on slender stilts, and beautifully wrought bridges stood in isolation over the waterways. Ships dotted the ocean, and the inner waterways were busy with smaller watercraft. The white metal spires pulsed here and there with colored lights, illuminated even during daytime to identify an island, a building, or a street. It was an attractive city, and most of its money came from tourism. People traveled from all over Calamar to holiday on Rahul Yon. And with tourists came the vultures and parasites who preyed on them. She was directed to a landing platform on a high tower on one of the outer islands. There were scores of gracefully wrought landing pads and bays around the tower, and exterior elevators whisked up and down its uneven sides. Even the city's air and spaceport was beautiful. As the peacemaker settled, Lannery prepared herself for what was to come. Her mission started here. "Keep an eye on the ship," she said to the droid. It grumbled and clicked. "Yes, I'll have my comm link." She felt the sliver of tech in her lapel just to make sure. Then she stood within the cabin and smoothed down her clothing, checking that her sword was strapped correctly to her thigh, ran fingers through her hair. She used her metal Jedi star to fix her cape around her neck. For now, there was no need to hide. She was surprised to realize that she was nervous. Somewhere at the end of this mission, her brother waited. Like any visitor who had landed on one of the spacecraft platforms, Lannery was directed through to a large room with lines of interview pods. One entire side was a window offering staggering views across Rahul Yon and the glimmering sea beyond, and the opposite wall was splayed with extravagant artwork that labeled it the Welcome Hall. But its real purpose was obvious. Calamar's security services were efficient and discreet, and even a Jedi was not simply waved through. She respected that. And by the time she was ushered from her interview pod, the 3 officers inside also respected her privacy. A subtle push, a gentle word. Perhaps in a few days' time they might start to question their decisions to let her in so lightly, although by then she would be long gone. But by the time she had traveled on 3 elevators down through the tower to ground level, Lannery began to suspect that she was being followed. She paused in the vast lobby of the port tower, bought a drink from a vendor droid, and melted into the shadows beneath a wide, low tree. There were tables and chairs there, and a massively fat Zabrak woman was harvesting large insects from the tree's lower canopy, flash-frying them, and selling them to eager customers. Lannery decided she was not hungry. As she drank, she watched the bank of elevators she had just left. Her sense of being followed was strong, but though she waited for a while, none of those exiting the elevators seemed to be looking for her. Strange. She was certain it was not one of the customs officers.
"Lady, you're a fine one,"
a voice said. A tall, robed figure had approached, and she was annoyed with herself for not noticing. "I'm drinking," she said.
"So drink with me."
"No, thanks."
"Come on, Ranger. You're young. I'm almost 200 years old. Got experience. Got 3 bottles of Che wine in my rooms. Almost as old as me, just waiting for a special occasion."
She rested her hand on her sword's haft. The force was calm and settled, and the weapon was part of her. Would losing your life constitute a special occasion? He stared at her from beneath his hood, amused, uncertain. Then he waved a hand and turned to leave.
"Ach, Jedi. So tightly wound."
She finished her drink, then moved out across the lobby area. There were hundreds of people there, a varied mix of the many species who had spread out from Tython to colonize the system. Humans and Wookiees mingled with Twi'leks, with their prominent headtails, and red-skinned Sith. Near-human Zabrak, with their vestigial horns, walked alongside Iktochi, whose heavy horns gave them a fearsome appearance. Kalamar had been the first planet settled after Tython and its moons, and it remained the most racially mixed and diverse. It was proud of its diversity, and it was a pride well earned. Even on Tython, it was rare that so many species were seen in one place at any one time, and Lannery paused for a moment in the center of the lobby to feel the ebb and flow of so many people in transit. She paused also to try to spot any pursuer. Still nothing. She'd seen no one obviously stop when she had. And although some people looked at her as they passed by, she sensed that it was only out of interest when they recognized the Jedi star. And on occasion, perhaps even distaste. She knew well enough that some Kalamar thought themselves above the Jedi. "I'm alone too often and for too long," she thought. Perhaps a subtle paranoia was a natural part of being among so many people once more. Leaving the spire's lobby, she passed a group of Daibendu monks chanting one of their strange, haunting ululations. A small group of travelers had settled around them, and some were swaying slowly in time with the song. Just outside the main doors, down a wide, long ramp that led to street level, a circle of feline Cathars was meditating upon an image of their god painted on the ground. The image was beautifully wrought, and their meditations had drawn several smoke snakes up from the ground to dance in a slow, hypnotic pattern. Lannery had heard of the Cathars' smoke snakes, but never seen them. Such diverse beliefs, being celebrated in such close proximity. Her immersion in the Force meant that she believed neither, but it was still pleasing to see such inclusivity. The streets outside were bustling with people, trade stalls, performance artists, religious groups, speakers, security officers, and children and adults alike pointing and chattering in delight at their surroundings. She felt almost unnoticed, and she welcomed that. But she also knew that it was an ideal environment in which to be followed, and that feeling persisted. Though she cast her Force sense around, there were so many people that her thoughts were confused. She would have to remain alert. Cloud chasers floated above, and occasionally drop ships came down to pick up passengers. But Lannery had studied maps on her ship, and knew that the tavern she sought was close by. She chose to walk.
"Bet you've never seen one like me, eh? Eh?"
Trisana grinned at her over his glass of wine. His yellow eyes and blazing red skin gave him a fearsome appearance, but she perceived a gentle intelligence behind the startling exterior. "Your coloring is quite rare," Lannery said. "Rarer still for a Twi'lek, the Xrelekoo."
"Rarer? Oh, yeah, rarer indeed."
He stroked the third head tail that grew behind the usual two.
"At least you use the right terminology. You wouldn't believe what some people call these things."
"I probably would."
"They call me Freak."
He growled suddenly and leaned forward, baring teeth that seemed to have been filed down to points.
"A scary freak."
"You don't scare me," she said. Tree's Leku, those three long, curious tentacles growing from the back of his skull, twitched a little. One tip stroking over his left shoulder, the other two pointing like fingers tapping at the air. "Yeah, well, this bitch is a Jedi," Lannery translated. Tree's eyes opened wide.
"You know Twi'leki?"
"Of course. That surprises you?"
"Huh. Huh. Nothing about the Jedi can surprise me."
"Oh, don't be so sure." Lannery took a drink and looked around Susko's tavern. With more than 15 settled planets and moons, and spread over 16 billion kilometers, there were places like this all across the Typhon system. Places where people gathered to drink, eat, and talk, no matter what their color, species, creed, or breed. Where music played in the background, either a local tune or perhaps something more exotic from another continent or another world. Where travelers found common ground, and those who chose not to travel could hear outlandish tales of faraway places. And it was in these taverns that tongues could be loosened, news spread, and secrets overheard. Lannery loved places like this, because often after a drink or two, she could have been anywhere. The drink she was sipping now had been recommended by Tree, a local wine made from deep-sea grapes and fortified with swing dust from some of the air mines at Calamar's North Pole. It was incredibly strong, but she used a gentle force flow to make sure the potent drink did not impede her senses. She might enjoy such taverns, but she had been attacked in places like these, and she had also killed in them. "Master Dan Powell vouches for you," Lannery said. Trisana's eyes glimmered with humor.
"Oh, I doubt that."
"Well, she says to watch you, and that I should kill you the first moment you display any hint of betrayal." Lannery looked around the tavern but probed for Tree's reaction. Strange. She felt nothing. She turned back to him and said, "But Dan Powell assures me you don't have a traitorous bone in your body." Tree raised his brows, and his Leku, resting now over his shoulders, performed a gentle, almost sensuous touch along their tips. "Good," Lannery said, smiling. "Then let's take a meal, and at the same time share some information."
"The sea beef is very good here," Tree said.
He raised a hand and caught the attention of the barman. A wave and a click of his fingers, and the barman nodded back, grinning. Lannery probed outward and touched the barman's mind. She took a startled breath. She could never really prepare for experiencing another's thoughts, as the first rush was always overwhelming. But she quickly filtered out the random, the violent, the sick and disgusting, and narrowed to what she sought.
"Tree so cool, so calm, so red, sitting there with her. Bet you die, and he'd be lucky. She'd eat him alive."
She broke away and stared at Tree until he averted his yellow eyes. But she said nothing. She knew she was attractive, and if he was thinking of her that way, there was no real harm. "I'll be very open with you," Lannery said. "Very honest. That's a good way to begin for both of us. There's something about you I can't read, but I don't need the force to understand people. You're haughty and superior. Maybe that's just you, but right now I think it's because you think you have me at a disadvantage. Perhaps because Dan Powell has told you most, if not all, of what I know and why I'm here." Tree blinked softly, his Leku touching in gentle acknowledgement. "And so you know whom I seek. You'll know that he's my brother. I have rumors and stories told in taverns, second-hand information from sources I can't verify and don't trust. and the sum of all the information I have gives me virtually nothing to go on. I don't even know what planet he's on right now.
You can't,
He waved his fingers, raised his arms up and down.
Force his location?
Lannery glared at Tree. His childish display did not warrant a response. Master Dan Powell sent me to you and said you might be able to help. I hope so, because I don't know how much more of this piss I can take. Lannery emptied her glass in one swallow.
And now I'll be very open with you, too,
Tree said, suddenly serious.
Along with talk of your brother, I hear rumors of Gree technology.
Lannery inclined her head, raised an eyebrow.
I don't mean the Hypergate. Anyone with half a mind knows of the theories about the old city being of Gree origin.
Tree leaned in closer, glancing around.
I mean, what drives the Hypergate.
I don't understand, she said, but already she was thinking of what the Masters had told her back on Typhon. Dark matter.
I mean there are whispers of design plans, tech details.
Tree shrugged.
Blueprints. And all Gree.
Lannery leaned back in shock.
Gree? Really?
So little was known about that ancient people. There were theories that the Gree had once inhabited the old city on Typhon, but theorists were split as to whether the Gree had built it themselves. Though the Gree were long gone from the galaxy, it was suggested by some that the old city was even more ancient. Lannery had met a man on Typhon, not a Jedi, but someone allied to them in Outlook, who had spent his life researching the Gree and their legacy, and even what he knew could be relayed in little more than an hour of talk. And now, this mysterious Twi'lek, who, if what Dan Powell had told her was true, undertook criminal activities, was claiming that Dale had found something the Gree had left behind.
Blueprints?
She asked.
Only what I've heard.
More wine? Lannery bristled. He was toying with her, playing a Jedi Ranger as he would a weak-minded, petty criminal looking to muscle in on some nefarious deal. She leaned back in her chair and feigned tiredness, but behind her drooping eyelids she felt the Force flow, stirring her senses, boosting them, and she probed outward once again to touch Tree's mind. But he was close to her. Tree's eyes went wide, and for a moment he looked unaccountably sad, shoulders dropping and Leku slumping down exhausted. He looks like a battered pet, Lannery thought. She wasn't sure where the image came from, but she had grown to trust her first impressions. The Force resided in her subconscious, too, and sometimes it spoke. He would not meet her gaze, staring instead into his half-empty glass. She sensed around the fringes of his mind, but could not get in, and it was something she was not used to. Some species were very hard to read. The Cathars' minds worked in a very different way, thinking in symbols and abstracts rather than words and images. But usually, she could at least touch another's mind, whether human or alien. Trees had a wall. It seemed to encircle his consciousness, and her efforts rebounded from it, almost hinting that there was no mind at all. Yet she knew that was not the case. Tree was very much his own person, intelligent and alert, harboring desires and aims, and she could see that he knew himself well. Very well. Tree, what's been done to you? She asked, because she sensed that he wanted to talk. The feeling was nothing to do with the Force. It was merely the empathy of one sentient being for another.
Just another slave spy used by the Jedi.
You're altered, she said, realizing the startling truth. Genetic?
Deep and permanent.
No Jedi would do that, she said.
Ha!
Tree spat. A few people nearby glanced around at his outburst, and he stared them down, red and ferocious when he wanted to be. They went back to their drinks. But it's, Lannery said, but she did not finish her sentence.
Forbidden, she was going to say.
But she had that ongoing alchemy experiment on her ship, and she knew that some Jedi would frown on that. What was considered forbidden to some was exploration to others. I'm Dan Powell's toy, Trisana said, quieter now.
There are promises made to me.
He sat up straighter, proud.
And they'll be kept. Money, a new identity, an estate on a Skalgoran city ship.
He nodded firmly, but his leku writhed, displaying uncertainty and vulnerability. Lannery wasn't sure what to make of him, and the fact that he was closed to her gentle probings unsettled her. But she could also not help admiring Dan Powell's work. Whatever subtle genetic adaptations she had performed, whatever strange alchemies kept Tree's mind purely his own, but made him very obviously hers, were perhaps immoral, yet startlingly brilliant. And you'll get all that, Lannery said. Master Dan Powell is a Jedi of her word. Their food arrived. Tree started eating immediately, chewing and swallowing with barely a pause. He seemed ravenous. The Gree, Lannery asked. The blueprints. I need to know more.
And now you're here, we can know more, Tree said, spitting half-chewed meat across the table. Some of it landed on Lannery's plate.
When?
I need to find someone, he said. Someone who's not easy to find, but on my own. A ranger will attract attention. You know the saying, when a ranger comes calling, trouble quickly follows. Well, so they hear of you with me, and they'll melt away, maybe for a long time. So leave it to me. Meet me here at dusk. I'll know where they are by then.
Who is this person?
A rich Calamar. A dealer in swing dust and other air spices. And a stargazer.
That word again, Lannery said. Tree wiped his mouth and took a drink.
Not one that many know. Don't use it too freely.
He nodded down at Lannery's plate.
You going to eat that?
No, help yourself. Tree pulled her plate across to him and started eating. It was as if every bite was his first. So, here, at dusk, Lannery said.
Hmm.
He nodded without looking up from the food. He exuded indifference, yet he had called himself a slave. A conflicted character. Complex. Troubled. Exactly who she would not want guiding her during her investigations. Fine, she said. As she stood to leave, she saw faces turning away from her, and she walked to the doorway in a bubble of silence broken only by awed whispers of Ranger and Jedi, and darker mutterings of Trouble. She hoped the old saying Tree had reminded her of could be put to rest on Calamar. But hope alters nothing. And soon after leaving Susko's tavern, Lannery knew that she was being followed again.
The first day is always the worst,
the human, Master Turkay, says as he leads Lannery and Dale toward the surface.
The silent desert can be an unsettling place.
We know, Lannery thought. We know for sure. They climb up through the vast cavern. It's more like a city than a temple, Lannery thinks, and Turkay glances back at her.
Listen when I'm talking or you'll learn nothing.
He speaks in her mind. He's not angry. More amused, if anything. Her surprise at how easily he silently communicates is obviously evident in her expression. Forced telepathy is well known to her, but such control and command must have taken many years of meditation and study to master. Turkay laughs aloud, and Lannery smiles sidelong at Dale. He's frowning. He didn't hear a thing. She is still stunned at the size and scope of Qigong. She's heard all about it, of course, from her parents, and from those journeyers venturing through Bodhi Temple after having visited Qigong previously on their travels. Their talk is always of the temple first, its incredible size, the complexity of its caverns and tunnels, the strength of the force in this natural nexus. And then inevitably they will finish with stories of the silent desert. A haunting place. Almost unnatural. She and Dale have already spent days crossing the desert to Qigong and encountering some of its dangers. But she senses that their real experience of those strange sands has only just begun.
It's cool down here,
Turkay says.
Sometimes the sands are hot enough to melt your shoes, and the slightest breeze will blister your skin. But that's usually later in the day. Down here, we're protected from the sun, and the climate is controlled by 6 conditioners. There's one over there.
They are crossing a wide cavern bounded on 3 sides with sheer walls, each of them speckled with ledges and stairwells, people bustling all about. Turkey points at the 4th side of the plaza, and there stands a huge machine, the height of 30 people, with curved protuberances that flex and bulge like something biological, not mechanical. It steams, groans, and moisture speckles its surface and pools around its base.
"That's a machine?"
Dale asks.
"Of sorts,"
Turkey sends. He glances at Lannery, raises an eyebrow, then speaks the words aloud. He expects Dale to be hearing all this, Lannery thinks. Her brother seems unaware, enwrapped as he is with the giant conditioner. "Of sorts?" Lannery asks.
"Many of its inner workings are grown at Anil Kesh."
"So it's alive?"
"Far from it."
Turkey turns and strides across the cavern floor, and they have to hurry to catch up.
"When we reach the surface, all will fall silent,"
Turkey says in Lannery's mind.
"But silence is subjective. You and I can communicate as we are now, and this is the first lesson. Force telepathy is a talent that some journeyers already have when they arrive here, but those who don't pick it up quite quickly."
He glances back over his shoulder at her, grim-faced.
"It's a fundamental talent, not like farsight or using the Force to cast illusion. If you flow with the Force, then so can your words and thoughts. But your brother..."
He shrugs as they continue walking. "He's..." Lannery begins, but Dale looks at her. She coughs, pretending to have swallowed some dust. Then she tries to speak without words. Her mother had taught her the basics. Sometimes her father touched her mind when it was late and they were tired, giving her a bedtime tale. Now was Lannery's chance to use those lessons. "He's slow with the Force," she sends, and she knows that Master Turkey hears. "But he wants to learn."
"No,"
Turkey says.
"I sense no eagerness in him, only resistance. No delight, only suspicion."
"He'll do his best." They reach the edge of the cavern, where a large opening in one wall leads to small, busier tunnels. 6 armed droids amble back and forth offering drinks. Taller droids provide physical care to a group of people who are dressed in grubby clothing, their skins sun-reddened, faces drawn, and eyes haunted. They don't stop talking, as if it's a novelty. Lannery suspects these are journeyer students having just finished another surface lesson.
"If he will do his best, then so will I,"
Turkey says, but Lannery already hears his doubt. It seems to echo her own. Master Turkey speaks then, including them both.
"The main climb to the surface. There are elevators and rising tubes, but I like my students to walk. Physical exercise."
He thumps his chest and laughs.
"Good for the lungs, the heart."
And he strokes his forehead.
"The health of the body feeds the health of the mind."
They start climbing the naturally formed stairway. Lannery counts more than 1,000 steps. Their first evening, as the sun blazes red across the western desert, and the sands come alive with scorpions and serpents and other shadowy things, Lannery forces an illusion before Master Turkey. A shire with graceful veined wings and a single horn protruding from its head dances in the sand, beating its hooves against shadows that do not notice, snorting, and she hears every beat and breath. Turkey smiles at the solocorn that prances before him, and he nods once at Lannery.
"Good work,"
he speaks silently.
"But you'll find that making an illusion of reality that much harder. You know the solocorn is a creature of myth, rich in your mind, and so an illusion is easy to form. Try something more mundane. A rock, a fruit, a shoe. Not so easy."
Lannery lets the illusion flitter away in the dusk and does as Turkay suggests. She cannot do it.
Your lessons have only just begun, Turkay says.
He turns away from her and sits close to Dale, holding the boy's hands in his own, touching his cheeks and his temples. And then the master closes his eyes, and Dale's own eyes grow wide.
He hears him, Lannery thinks, delighted. He feels the force and hears with it.
But her excitement is short-lived. Dale stands and kicks at the sand, sending it spraying into Master Turkay's face. He reacts like he has been invaded or touched by something disgusting. Then he turns and walks away into the twilight. Lannery wishes she could call her brother back. Their first dawn camped in the silent desert with Master Turkay is one of the strangest times of Lannery's life. Camping with Dale on their way here had been nothing like this. They were times of fear and worry, not wonder. Perhaps being so close to the temple, a natural nexus of the Force, drew life to that place. As the rising sun sets the eastern horizon aflame, the desert comes to life, and the silence seems more staggering than ever before. Night creatures have already gone to ground an hour before dawn, as if aware that sunlight will soon expose them. Shadows retreat. The coolness of the night is burned away, and shimmering heat haze dances across the sands. Desert birds take flight from wherever they sleep. A small species of shire, thinner than those elsewhere on Tython, with water humps on back and neck, moves in herds across a distant hillside. Lizards frolic and dance around rocky areas. Gliding pendles flap their mighty wings as they ride the dawn air currents, and she sees a giant mankle stalking in the distance, its vicious spines raised for the hunt. Yet this magnificent display of life and diversity exists in the desert's unnatural silence. The cries and calls, the flapping of wings, the growls and roars of the hunt, all unheard.
There, toward the hills. Look. Blink and you might miss it.
She was not even aware that Turkay had risen. His tent looks undisturbed, untouched. Yet as he speaks in her mind, she sees him hunkered down south of the camp, as motionless as the rock pile beside which he sits. She looks where he sat, and sees. There seems to be no wind lifting the sand, no disturbance in the ground that might raise such a thing. The sculpture looks about the size of a human, though distance can be deceptive. It seems fluid, moving and dancing as the billions of sand particles within constantly shift and flow. The shape is ambiguous.
Dale should see this, Lannery thinks.
Yet she knows she cannot wake him with a thought, and to move him might break this moment.
Reach,
Turkay says, and Lannery reaches. The Force is alive within her, and she probes outward with her senses, feeling that distant sand sculpture is slightly warmer than the surrounding sand. Its smell is like something long buried exposed at last. And most amazingly of all, within its confines, the sand sings out loud. The sound is confused and seems to make no sense. There are no words there that Lannery knows. Yet she can sense something of unbridled freedom and passion in the noise, and for a few beats of her heart, she is filled with a blazing optimism that puts the sun to shame. Then the shape disintegrates, and with one more heartbeat it is returned to the desert. The sound has vanished. The movement has ceased. Lannery is left breathing hard with excitement, and as she glances across at Turkay, she catches his smile.
What is that?
A mystery. You should wake your brother. Your training starts again now.
They spend the rest of that day and the two following training in the silent desert. Lannery is delighted with the talents she possesses and those she is introduced to, and thrilled at how adept she already seems. Turkay pushes her, tests, and she performs, pushing back with silent requests for harder tasks, more complex problems. Her relationship with the Force expands rapidly in that silent place, and she feels fully a part of it for the first time. suggestion, telepathy, control. Her skills grow and expand with each passing moment. She enjoys her time there with Master Turkay. And yet many times she realizes the strength of her pride when she forgets that Dale is not finding any of this easy. He cannot flow with the Force, and the more Turkay works with him, the less Dale wants to try. Lannery becomes frustrated and annoyed with his frequent displays of petulance. In the evenings, when they are eating and relaxing, she tries communicating with him. A sisterly touch on his mind, born of love and concern. Yet she's met with a deluge of chaotic thoughts, frightening, furious, and yet scared. As dusk falls on the third day and they make their way back to the temple, Lannery is enlivened by her successes and saddened by Dale's failures. She takes his hand, surprised when he holds on, and she smiles at him. She has an idea. A subtle push, and they are walking along the river back at home, close to Bodhi Temple. This is the one place where Dale feels most at peace with himself. Weave birds have been here recently, and countless golden threads are carried on the breeze. The river flows fast and heavy, swollen by recent rains in the hills of the Edge Forest. The air smells of blossom and hangs heavy with the promise of a family meal that evening, when their father will cook rumbat stew and their mother will read some of her poetry. It is beautiful.
It is false.
Dale squeezes her hand so tightly that she feels bones grinding, and the hookhawk wounds start to bleed again. Then he crumples to his knees in the sand and vomits. Lannery kneels beside him, wondering if she has done wrong. He hates her touching his mind, using the Force to invade his thoughts. They have fought about it more than once. But after so long in this strange place, she'd thought that perhaps he would have welcomed those thoughts of safety and calm, those images of home. When he looks up at her, she sees the venom of his gaze. She cannot touch his mind again to say sorry. Chapter 4. His Own Man.
Never place all your reliance in the Force. It's always there, but that does not mean it can always be called upon. Each Jedi is his own person with his own talents. Learn to use them. Nurture them. If the Force is the dream, you are the dreamer, and sometimes you have to wake up. Sometimes you are all you have.
Master Shalmar, A Life in Balance, 7523 TYA, Thoyor Arrival. Trisana had already told her more than the Jedi Masters who had sent her on this mission. They had mentioned a loose network of rich Kalamar, apparently involved in Dale's Stargazer sect, and Tri had backed that up with talk of tracking down a particular person to question. They had spoken of dark matter being used to attempt activation of a supposed hypergate. But they had not mentioned the Gree at all. What was known about the Gree was so far back in history, so deep in time, that it had taken on the sheen of myth and legend. Lannery wanted to get back to her ship's computer to find out what she could. But first, she had to discover who or what was following her. She imagined that this district of Rahol Yon must be somewhere at the lower end of the tourist experience. The streets were grubby. Some vendors very probably dealt in illegal goods, services, or substances, and the clientele of the various establishments displayed little evidence of being mere visitors. A rough area, but not one in which Lannery felt out of place. Every city on every planet had them, and she had visited many. Sometimes she fit right in. Cloud chasers drifted above. Speeders buzzed along a slightly raised roadway in the center of the street, and several types of indigenous beasts of burden carried people on their backs or limbs. But Lannery chose to walk. It meant that she had complete control of her movements, and it would be easier to keep watch. She wanted to draw her follower out, not escape from him or her. She used the polished shine of speeders, the glass of display windows, and the reflections in the eyes of those passing by to look behind her. And when she could not see, she blinked slowly, casting her senses back to try and discover who and where her pursuer was. It was frustrating. She felt observed, and it could no longer be the usual curiosity for a Jedi Ranger. She had removed her Ranger star to try to blend in. The end of the street opened up into a large market, stalls built across a wide, marble-paved square and suspended on three massive tree-like structures around the square's perimeter. Small cloud chasers moored at some of these trees, ferrying people and freight to and from the larger vessels that buzzed and drifted above. Lannery trotted down the curved stone steps that led to the square. Then she stopped, turned, and ran back up. She paused on the top step and looked around. The street she had walked along was bustling. She looked at people walking toward and past her, human and otherwise. She watched many more walking away. Probing with her senses, touching the pulse of the Force, she felt for any image of herself in someone else's regard, and found it.
Just standing there, watching. Don't forget she's a Ranger. Dangerous. Mysterious.
She touched the haft of her sword and pulled it partway out of its sheath, turning, seeing a Cathar family paused 20 paces from her while the mother and father fussed over their 6 children. Standing just behind them, pretending to be a part of their group and yet so obviously not, was a shape that did not belong. The man was small but stocky, wearing an expansive gray robe and a large mask. Lannery was sure he was Nogri. Reptilian, skilled fighters, prized assassins. As she laid eyes on him, he looked up and met her gaze. She raised one hand, ready to force push him to the ground for the moment she'd need to reach him. He pulled a laser blaster and fired into the family group. Screams, panic, people running, fleeing, falling. The Nogri fired again, shooting at random. Lannery drew her sword and ran at the shooter. He was already fleeing, blaster in one hand and something else in the other. She could not make out what the device was. She reached for him, shoved, but he dodged sideways, and her force punch tripped a beast of burden, spilling its 3 passengers. As she passed the Cathar family, she glanced down and saw the woman on the ground, blood pulsing from a terrible black-tinged wound in her furry scalp. The father was trying to pull the children away while crying out in mad grief. Lannery wanted to stay and help, but there would be others to do that. She would best serve the dead woman by catching her killer. The Nogri had flowed down the steps and was sprinting toward one of the mooring stations. When they saw him coming, most people moved away, his violent intent obvious. But when 2 militia crouched before him and aimed long, spear-like weapons at him, he shot them both. The movement was almost too quick to be seen, and as they fell back dead, the killer was already entering the shadow of the mooring tree. He was well trained. It would take someone who knew what he was doing to bring down those 2 guards without pause. She was gaining on him as he entered one of several doorways into the cloud chaser mooring structure. He was still doing something with the object in his other hand, and she paused and reached for him, concentrating, willing the force his way, her clawed hand closing slowly as she struggled to grasp him. But there were too many other people around, and the panic was too great. More laser blasts erupted from the interior lobby of the mooring platform, and more screams. Lannery used the force to increase her speed, willing her muscles to stretch and contract faster, pumping her arms, pushing blood through her veins. There were 100 travelers and merchants in the lobby, and 2 people were on the ground with blood spattered around them, others rushing to help. But she saw the Nogri immediately. He was plugging the device into a comm column. He glanced back over his shoulder but did not raise his blaster. More concerned with sending whatever he has to send, she thought. And as she ran at him, she reached for the comm column, probing, frowning in concentration. She had to stop him sending, and if... She heard the dry cough of a blaster and raised her sword, and it was only that instinctive reaction that saved her.
The shot struck the sword and she stumbled backward, then fell, her weapon clanging against the marble floor. She still grasped its haft. She would never let it go. And she could feel the heat dispersing from the exquisite blade. Lannery shoved, and 40 paces away, the Nogri was lifted from his feet and smashed back against a wall. The blaster dropped from his hand and skittered away across the floor. The crowd of people had scattered and hidden as well as they could, leaving only the two shot people behind. Lannery sensed that they were both dead. Anger throbbed through her, but she reined it in. It would feed her action, but it could also cloud her senses. Using the Force while harboring rage could upset the balance within her, and that would lead to mistakes. She jumped to her feet, and she was the only person standing. "Stay down!" she shouted. She held out her hand and force-pressed her observer to the ground. Heard him gasping for air. Pressed a little harder. Walking forward, sword held protectively before her, Lannery glanced at the comm column and the device he had attached there. A flurry of movement, and she knew what was coming. Lifting the sword to deflect the blast a blink before it came. Another followed. She shifted to the left and raised her blade to the right. The shot was swallowed by the hot metal. He'd been carrying a second concealed blaster. Lannery grunted in frustration, then reached out and lifted the Nogri above the ground, grasping him there, tight, tighter. "Drop it," she said. Though quiet, her voice carried all across the open lobby. He dropped the weapon. She raised him even higher, then let go. The sound of breaking bone as he struck the ground was followed by the collective gasps of those watching. Lannery ran to him. He was writhing, his gray-skinned leg twisted, protruding bone visible beneath his loose robe. Keeping an eye on his big, clawed hands and feet, and conscious of the Nogri's reputation as fighters and killers, she kept her sword drawn in case he had other concealed weapons. And as she knelt by his side, she reached for his mask.
"Hold him!"
someone called. Militia. Lannery cursed inwardly, knowing that this would now get complicated. She wanted to get him somewhere quiet to interrogate him, and handing him over to Kalamar Militia would gain her nothing. She sighed and looked up at the two uniformed women running her way, wondering if she could persuade them otherwise.
"He shot them and just..."
"She chased him in here and she threw him. She must be Jedi, and..."
"Dead. My brother's dead. And leaking his brains all across..."
There was a flood of voices as terrified people started speaking around the edges of the concourse. And in that cacophony, one shout from a child that saved Lannery's life.
"Look out!"
As she looked back down at the injured Nogri, she saw the shell of his mask peel back and a wisp of smoke from within. Voice activated, she had time to think, and then she put every shred of strength and every measure of power she had in the Force into shielding herself from what came next. She barely heard the explosion. For a moment, as she saw the Wookiee's face and felt its strong, furry hands hauling her to her feet, she thought she was back on Skogora, with her fingers hovering over laser cannon triggers. Then she remembered what had happened, and smelled acrid smoke on the air. "I'm fine," she said. Dizziness swept over her, and she composed herself, breathing deeply. The female Wookiee grumbled a question, and Lannery nodded.
"Really? Fine."
The few people around her, the Wookiee, several humans, a tall, eyeless Miraluka with slatted mask, observed in stunned silence. When Lannery looked beyond them, she understood their amazement at her survival. The Nogri had packed quite a blast. There was nothing left of him, and the site of the explosion was the center of a wide swath of blackened and broken marble. Detritus littered the lobby. He had killed himself without a second thought, and it was incredible that no one else had been caught by the blast. "I was there," Lannery thought, looking at the small, cracked crater in the marble floor. She had been blasted across the lobby, protected and shielded by the Force that she was so rich in, and for a few moments, she tingled with something approaching ecstasy. She took a deep breath and felt a rush of well-being. Perhaps it was relief. Or maybe she was simply realizing that it was good to be alive.
You! A voice called. Jedi!
It was one of the militia who'd been approaching when the Nogri had killed himself. The other was bloodied and being helped to her feet. As the woman drew closer, Lannery glanced quickly around at the comm columns. One side of it had taken some of the blast, but it remained standing, though bent and twisted. She could see the comm point in which the Nogri had plugged his device. She ran.
Stop!
The militia woman called again, angry. Lannery would have to be careful. The woman was shaken, and in the confusion, she might decide to take a shot. Lannery raised one hand, smiled, then slowed to a walk. Just here, she said, pointing. Just going here.
Stop, or I'll...
You'll wait for me, Lannery said, pushing softly.
I'll wait for you,
the woman said, frowning even as she stopped running. She looked around as if confused, and then Lannery reached the comm column. She examined the device briefly, then plucked it from the socket. It was a small black box with several connectors and a screen on one side. A camera, among other things. Lannery tapped the screen and scrolled down the list of stored images. They were all of her.
When a ranger comes, death always follows, the man said.
I thought the saying was danger always follows.
Whatever.
They had taken her to the nearest militia post, and Lannery had gone without argument. Her assignment had already become more complex than she had hoped, and making herself a fugitive would mean answers would be even more difficult to come by. People were dead. She owed it to the Kalamar authorities to answer their questions. Besides, she would be meeting Tree again at dusk. She had time to kill. The captain was Loras, a tall member of the proud Sith species, powerfully built and obviously used to being a leader and having his orders obeyed and demands met without question. He seemed unperturbed at holding a Jedi in his restraining cell. He must have known that she could likely escape at any moment, but that would cause a diplomatic incident. So for now, there was a gentle balance between them, an act from which both sides might benefit. The fact that they both knew this made things easier. At any other time, it might have been amusing.
Something funny, Jedi?
No, not really. And I've told you my name.
I prefer to call you Jedi.
Very well, Loras.
You should address me as Captain Loras.
I should? The captain sighed and leaned against a wall. The two human militia who had brought her in stood in the corners of the room at either side of the door. They both looked afraid and stared at her in open wonder. Probably the first time they had seen a Jedi in action. The room was a little larger than the main control room on her Peacemaker, with one door, several chairs around the edges, and the single containment cell at its center. The cell was too small to lie down in, and consisted of an archaic heat field instead of bars. Lannery could feel a touch of heat where she stood. The generator was old and leaking, and knew that she'd be singed to a crisp if she moved too close to the shimmering walls. She also knew that she could knock out the generator with a single thought, and with a little more effort she could shield herself and walk straight through the heat field. But she had no wish to fight Captain Loras and his constables.
Five dead,
Loras said. Six, sir, one of the militia women said. Loras stiffened but did not turn around, and the woman became suddenly nervous.
Including the bomber.
I don't care about the bomber, Loras said. There are five people dead who I care about, including two of my militia.
Sir, the woman said, quieter. I didn't kill any of them, Lannery said.
They're dead because the bomber was following you.
Yes.
Why?
I'm here on Jedi Council orders, Lannery said.
Why?
I can't reveal the purpose of my assignment.
Why?
Loras smiled. Lannery did not respond. She looked down at her feet and probed softly, so gently that she hoped he would not feel. What she discovered did not surprise her. He enjoyed the power his position gave him. He was something of a bully toward his staff. And though he had been in the presence of Jedi before,
He had no love for them. "I've done nothing to make you hate me," Lannery said. Loras's face fell. "I know your mind, and there's more I can do."
"Not if I press the purge button on your cell and fry you to a crisp."
Lannery said nothing. Silence was more effective. It projected confidence. Loras snorted.
"Jedi. Rangers. I knew a ranger once, several years ago. Volk. Did you know him?"
"No," Lannery said. But she remembered the name and the sadness of people she loved. "My parents knew him."
"Arrogant. Superior. He moved me out of the way once. I was a constable then, still in training, and he'd arrived close to here with two younger Jedi. Those you call journeyers. Too young and unable to control the powers you give them. Troublesome. There was a dispute at the time. Two of the richer Kalamar families bickering over mining rights for some distant asteroid or other. Volk said he'd come to settle the dispute before it came to blows. Never did know why the Jedi were involved. Don't care. But when I confronted him in the street, told him I had questions and that he and his young troublemakers would have to follow me, he told me there wasn't time. Said he had a meeting to attend and a gift to make, otherwise blood would be spilled. And then he lifted his hand and moved me aside. Picked me up. Almost throttled me with that damned force you people mess with. Dropped me out of his path. Walked on without giving me another glance.
Lannery smiled. She could not help it, even knowing it would only enrage this proud, simple man more. But she had heard her parents talking of Volk, and this sounded exactly like the man he had been. He had never permitted anything to obstruct what he thought was right. It was a lesson her parents had taught her well.
"You'd laugh at me, Jedi?"
Loras said. Only at Volk's memory.
"You did know him, then?"
"No. Like I said, my parents did. And it was more than several years ago. Volk died 8 years ago in a cloud chaser crash 1,000 kilometers from here. But I guess you're so parochial you won't have heard about that. He'd already killed 14 Zhang terrorists by then, and he was mortally wounded. He steered his ship away from populated areas, saving hundreds, maybe thousands. He crashed into the sea." Lannery said no more. But she watched Loras's expression change, subtly but definitely, and she was glad. It seemed the man had some measure of honor after all. "So tell me about the dead Nogri," Lannery said. Loras grunted. "I'll not move you out of the way." She smiled, pleased to see a twitch of response on Loras's lips. He stared at her for a moment, then nodded at one of the militia. The woman pressed switches on a control panel on the wall. The heat field imprisoning Lannery shimmered and then faded, whispering away to nothing. Loras sat and gestured at a seat opposite him.
"He's known," Loras said. "There wasn't much left of him."
Grinning, he pointed back over his shoulder at the female militia.
"Ducianne found one of his toe claws snagged in her uniform. We identified him from security footage taken from the docking tree. What we don't know is why a preacher would become a killer."
"A preacher?" Lannery asked. "He was no gray, wasn't he? Preaching isn't something they're known for."
"A cult," Loras said. "There are many across Kalamar, too many to keep track of. Unlike your Tython, we're inclusive here. We welcome any species, creed, or breed."
"As do we. But Tython is a challenging place for a non-Jedi."
"Yeah, well, the Nogri was a stargazer."
"What do you know about them?" Lannery sat down, at ease, comfortable. She was loading her questions with the subtlest of force pushes, barely a suggestion. And perhaps now she was getting somewhere.
"Not much,"
Loras said, shrugging. His red Sith skin looked strange in the artificial light, the color deeper, bloodier.
"They're one of the lesser sects, hardly any members, no real influence. One of many who seek to look beyond the Tython system, way back into history. I've had no dealings with them before. They've never caused trouble."
He frowned.
"Until now."
"They want to go home," Lannery said, remembering Dale once saying,
"One day I'll find my way home." There are many who maintain an interest in where our ancestors came from, who resent that we were ever brought to Tython at all.
Are you one of them?
Not at all,
Loras said.
I've got it good here.
Lannery asked more questions about the Stargazers, information held on them, and any prominent members. She barely touched Loras's mind, and he seemed not to notice. Without hesitation, he consulted an old computer in the wall and gave her a name and address.
Ah, yes, Kara. She's not openly affiliated with the Stargazers, but she's incredibly rich, made her fortune in swing dust mining, and it's whispered that she funds them, lets them stay in properties she owns around Rahul Yon and beyond. But these are just whispers. I've found no proof.
Really? Lannery raised an eyebrow.
I've had no need to look. The Stargazers haven't done anything wrong.
5 counts of murder?
And that's for me to investigate. Please, Jedi, don't explode this one. She's one of Rahul Yon's elite, and it would leave much more of a mess.
I'll do my best, Lannery said. I'm grateful for your time. And with a nod to the two militia, she exited the holding room. She glanced back once to see Loras staring into the inactive cell, frowning, and probably already wondering who had interrogated whom. Leaving the militia post, Lannery quickly lost herself in the bustle of late afternoon.
Someone tried to kill me,
Tree said. Seems quite common around here.
You too?
Lannery shrugged. Who was it?
I didn't see. A shot, then they were gone.
You don't seem overly troubled.
It's not the first time it's happened.
Trisana tried to exude calm, but there were signs of his being flustered, his clothing a little awry, eyes flickering left and right, Leku unsettled. They had met outside Susko's tavern and then walked through the streets. It was evening now, and everywhere was a different kind of busy. Earlier, the walkways had been thronged with residents and visitors all going somewhere, a purpose in their strides. Now the ebb and flow was less urgent, destinations less certain. They drank and ate, and music emanated from many establishments, vying for the greatest volume and subtlest lure. It was a more relaxed scene than earlier, but more chaotic. Dirigibles floated above the city, the larger intercontinental ships higher up illuminated with extravagant displays that danced and pulsed light across the sky. Smaller craft drifted down and rose again, ferrying people from docking trees up to the larger vessels. Several were moving away to the east, and Lannery wondered what lay in that direction. She had already contacted her peacemaker to ensure that everything there was as it should be. Ironholgs had spat and buzzed as if annoyed at being disturbed, but all was well. She yearned to be back in the ship, alone.
Easy for someone to follow us out here,
Tree said. I'll know, she replied. And perhaps she would. She was much more alert now, and she kept her mind open to threatening thoughts, sudden movements, being the focus of attention. The Nogri had been more than willing to kill innocent bystanders to get away from her, until he'd made his broadcast, at least, and she could not let crowds be protection. But she could not know everything. And there were people like Tree who had been altered specifically so that they could not be read. Master Dan Powell, you should have told me more, Lannery thought. My brother knows I'm coming, Lannery said.
And he's trying to kill you?
She did not answer. The Nogri's camera had been plugged into the comm column to send the images of her, and it seemed likely that they were sent to Dale. From what the Jedi Masters had told her, he appeared to be the head of the Stargazers, or this faction at least. But why would the Nogri be so willing to kill himself rather than be captured? Loras had called them a cult, but they worshipped nothing. They craved a single purpose,